session number 7390, reel 2.
Colonel Grey, reel 2. You were telling me about the illness or weariness which you...
I was absolutely worn out. My eyesight, headaches and things like that. Because I'd been having to do decipherings, enciphering and all that lot, practically all by myself. And we were working with the candles out in the open. No tents, no nothing, living on the country. I was completely run down. And it was a day that Wingate arrived that I'm afraid that I went out, had a sort of blackout. However, they flew me in the next day into Khartoum, and I was there for a fortnight and had a nice rest holiday. And then they flew me back again in time for Wingate to start his push with the Sudanese Defence Force Battalion and an Ethiopian battalion onto Burie, which was one of the big Italian forts. There was a certain amount of slaughter there. There was no doubt at all about it. And we had them out after 2 days. They ran for it after 2 days. We captured quite a considerable number of Italians, but the others ran and retired to Deborah Marcos, which was further on down the road towards Addis Ababa, which was our next battle. We then headed for Deborah Marcos, which was one of the main towns in that area, and we thought that if we could capture that one, then the Italians would be heading straight back to Addis Ababa. By that time, the emperor had joined us, and he himself, on a horse, led us into Burie, which was a great day for the Ethiopians, of course, capturing their first large town. The battle for Deborah Marcos lasted 2 days, and once again, casualties were very, very heavy. The Sudan Defence Force lost 250 out of their 500, and the Ethiopians lost 180 out of their battalion and all our patriots. But it fell after 2 days, and once again the emperor was able to lead his troops into the Deborah Marcos. We then got in contact with the British forces which were coming up from Kenya, being led by General Cunningham, the East African forces. And we were told that they were heading for Harar, which was southeast of Addis Ababa, and so far they'd had very little contact with the Italians, and they were heading upwards very fast. In fact, it now developed into a race for Addis Ababa, whether the Sudan Defence Force under Wingate would get there first and beat Cunningham. But I'm afraid Cunningham got there first, and Addis fell on the 5th of April, and the emperor entered his state capital on the 5th of May 1941. This mission of ours, we lost two officers killed and two NCOs killed, and it cost $5,000, which is the equivalent of about £500. And we moved in 20,000 rifles with the ammunition for the revolt. There are only two more things now, and that was the battle of at Amber Lagi, where all three forces joined together. Our Ethiopian forces, General Cunningham's forces and Wingate's forces, and the Italians under the Duke of Aosta surrendered on the 17th of May 1941. That was almost the end of it. The final one was the Battle of Gondar, which is on the northern end of Lake Tana, which was a final Italian stand. They had 15,000 Italians there. And they surrendered to us after a pretty ghastly battle on the 27th of November 1941. So Ethiopia and Eritrea were completely freed from the Italians.
Could I ask you some questions about what you said? You were talking about how exhausted you got. Could you describe what your daily routine would have been from waking up until going to sleep?
Well, we very rare did we have a full night's sleep because somebody was coming in all the time. And I had two wireless stations on the go there, which I had to go on in between, making certain that things were going well with them. And Whitmore, who was my mechanic, we were always having sort of breakdowns there. And, well, we would work sometimes right through the night, you see. And I was also having to operate. And Whitmore and I were also doing the enciphering and deciphering of messages, code messages, that we had to send back to Khartoum. So really, and we were getting no exercise whatsoever. We were just sitting on our, sitting down most of the time, or working at the wireless set sort of thing. So really, we were completely worn out.
How many hours a day would you work on average then?
Oh, times 18, 20 hours sort of thing. And we were sleeping on the ground. There was no beds or anything then. We just had two blankets. That was your lot.
So were you just working and sleeping, or did you ever have days off?
Never had a day's off. Not one day off at all during the whole 6 months that we were going in there.
Was this situation because the Abyssinians couldn't take over any work from you?
Well, you see, we only had 12 operators altogether. That we trained, and during that short training period, we could not put half of them onto the wireless sets. They weren't capable of operating it, really. The war opened up so quickly that we hadn't finished our training. So it was only three operators who had previous training in France, and my British operators that were able to keep the sets going, and they were open sometimes 24 hours a day. So I had to take my turn on wireless operating as well as doing the ciphering, enciphering, etc. Sheer exhaustion, I think.
What type of messages were you dealing with?
Well, it was sending messages back to Khartoum to let them know what the situation was, receiving messages from them telling us what we should do or what they thought we could do, keeping contact with the forces that were out at Samford, and he was out on his own with the wireless station one time fighting one battle. Drew would be out, Dr. Drew, he would even be out with a party encircling one village or something like that. He'd have a set with him. And, well, if there was a spare set, well, Whitmore would be repairing that if he wasn't helping me to do the ciphering.
Can you remember any of the instructions, specific instructions that you got from Khartoum?
The main ones that I can remember, which affected us greatly, was that the fact that every now and again we were told by Khartoum that they had intercepted Italian messages back to Rome, to say they knew exactly where we were and what our forces were and our strength and things like that, you see, which gave us a good idea because we had to move and get out of the way fairly quick if they knew just where we were, because they still had a large air force there, which came over and strafed us every so often.
With any effect?
No, not really. I don't think we had more than about three wounds, and they were the Ethiopians.
Wouldn't it have been possible for them to have sent a ground force against you?
No, because, you see, with the revolt going, we liaise with the Ethiopian chiefs and the local kings, and we were encircling all their camps and keeping them inside there and stopping all convoys getting to them to replenish them. And that was the object. And putting the fear of God on them too by keeping them awake all night.
How did you do that?
well, put a few shots into them all the time from different quarters around the compass sort of thing.
And what did the standard of Italian intelligence seem to be?
Well, I think they used some of their Ethiopians who had been fighting with them to spy on us. And, of course, we didn't know one from the other. And they obviously came in, saw what we were doing, went back and told the Italians exactly what they saw there. Well, to the fact that, as I say, we sent in some of our own Ethiopians into the Italian camps to get food, cigarettes, eggs and things like that, buy them for us. I mean, if we could do it, so could they.
You mentioned problems with the machinery. What type of equipment problems did you have?
Well, as I said earlier on, those wireless sets were only made to cover 30 miles, and we were stretching them to 300 miles or more at times. And every now and again, an Ethiopian operator would have pulled out one of the cords or thing, and they knew nothing at all about the wireless set. So off Whitmore or myself had to go and check over the set to find out what was wrong and repair it, sort of thing.
Were you able to effect all the repairs?
In practically every case, yes. It was in most cases they were only minor. But where you have untrained natives operating them, once the thing stopped, they were lost. They didn't know what to do. They had no technical knowledge, which we didn't expect from them.
So you didn't run into any problems with spare parts?
Not really. Well, we had no spare parts. We just had those six sets which had come out from England, which I'd brought out from England, and they did extremely well, apart from the one that we lost in the river when we crossed the Blue Nile, the Abai.
Would you have had any problem with operating the sets in Ethiopia that you didn't have in Britain from the point of view of climate or terrain?
Yes. There were times when we were in what we call dead spots, and we just couldn't get out or in, communication in or out, and we had to move up from behind a mountain or something like that. We had to take a set up to the top of a mountain to clear some obstacle that was in the way. And we had very difficult communication with Khartoum as it was. I mean, we were stretching the things to the absolute limit. But there was one thing. When Wingate came in with his Sudan Defence Force, he had a signal section of Sudanese who were under a British officer called Morris. And they helped us a lot because they had British equipment, standard army equipment. So the Sudan Defence Force helped us out with the communications from there onwards. And we used our pack wireless sets only for the Ethiopian war parties, which we sent out. And Wingate had his own communications.
What about climatic problems for the equipment?
Stood it extremely well, considering that we went in through the rains, and when it rains in Ethiopia, it really does rain. And we got wet through, I don't know how many dozen times, all our equipment. And it was all battery-operated, of course. And how we managed to keep those things charged for those 6 months, I don't know.
What about climatic problems with transmitting and receiving?
There were times, of course, during the day on the long haul that we couldn't get through at all. And we just had to keep open until such times as the conditions changed and we could establish communications again.
What type of conditions were negative for you?
Mostly evening time and up to about midnight.
Why was that?
Just atmospheric conditions, I think. Signals just didn't get through.
What type of ciphers did you use?
We had what we called in those days one-page ciphers, which we lasted for a day, and then that was destroyed. And we had another type for the next day.
What do you mean by a one-page sci-fi?
Well, it was a set of letters, and you had another set, and an A on the one that we're using that day was, shall we say, a Z on the one that which we actually enciphered the message into. All very simple, but if we changed it every day like we did do, well, the Italians must have been fairly well confused. Although their directing finding, of course, direction finding, that is where they had us, because they could direct their finders onto us and get our position to the nearest half mile with their directors.
Did you intercept any, have any equipment for intercepting their messages?
No, we had nothing whatsoever. Neither did Wingate with his defence force. Perhaps Cunningham did with his East African, King's African Rifles, who were coming up from the south. They may have done. They were much better equipped than we were, of course. And, of course, you must remember that it was the very early part of the war when all the equipment was required for Britain, who we thought was being invaded at that time.
Can I ask you about some of the personalities? You said you met Wingate.
Yes.
What was your impression of him?
Well, he was a most unorthodox person, and not the type of army officer that I had been used to, of course. Because he would have his bag of nuts and his alarm clock, and he would go off, and he would expect his army to go along after him, and he could go for 24 hours on his bag of nuts and without stopping. And he used to do everything by his clock, his alarm clock.
Why didn't he have a watch?
I don't know. he was well known for carrying this alarm clock along with him.
Where did he have it?
He just carried it.
In his hand?
In his hand as he walked along with a stick. He had no arms whatsoever.
What was
no
the stick
rifle
for?
Or anything. Just to help him climb up hills and things like that. And to lean on.
And he lived on nuts?
Nuts and raisins and dates.
What kind of nuts did he have?
I couldn't tell you, I'm afraid. But he used to have the bag there, and he just put his hand in every now and again and take things out, put them in his mouth, and that's good enough for him for the next hour. But you can't do that with troops. They want their regular meals, if possible, and they want a reasonable amount of sleep at night. But he force-marched them. And give him his due. He knew what he was doing, and when he said he was going to take on these Italian camps, he planned it, and we were there, and we took it. We worked to his clock.
How many times did you meet him?
Well, I was with him for the best part of a month, from the time that we captured Bourrier until the time that he forged ahead with the Emperor from Deborah Marcos to go into Addis Ababa. But then I never saw him again.
In what other ways was he unorthodox?
Well, he never dressed as an officer. He'd have a dirty old shirt on and an old topi and something on his feet. Goodness knows what it was at times. And off he used to go. He used to just tell the people, the officers, what he wanted, what he was going to do, and off he went. And we had to carry on and do it.
Was he scruffy?
Very.
Was he tidy and systematic?
No, I don't think he was. Well, we didn't think so, because, I mean, instead of getting down and having a war powwow and checking on all the details of things, he would just work it out in his mind what he wanted and what he was going to do, and then he used to tell us what we had to do, and off he went, and we had to do what he told us.
What was his manner?
Very abrupt, but I don't think there's any doubt about it that he had a marvellous brain, and he'd worked it out in his brain in every detail, and he knew exactly what he wanted and what he wanted us to do. And he would give us the main instructions of what we had to do and leave us to get on and do it.
Did people take exception to his manner?
I don't think so. I think we were rather astounded with this general. We'd never met one like it before. But he was getting results. And as you know, if you've got a leader who gets the results, well, you follow him and you back him up, which we did.
Did he ever talk to you on a personal or social basis?
Very rare indeed. He did actually come to me when I was out, or nearly out, before I had to be flown in. And I think he stayed with me a couple of hours, which was a wonderful thing for him. I mean, his hours were so busily occupied. But apart from that, no. You never had much contact with him.
So you never got to know him as a man?
No. No. Not like Sanford. I mean, with Brigadier Sanford, we knew each other. We were sort of on Christian names. And he would discuss things with you and tell us what he thought and ask for our opinion of things like that. And not only that, of course, we used to have to get the Ethiopians in on our side because we were working with the Ethiopians, and he spoke Amharic, by the way. So he could tell them what we wanted them to do. So ours had to be very detailed discussions for our little Ethiopian army side of it.
Was Wingate aloof and isolated?
Yes, he was rather. He kept to himself very much indeed. He had a Israeli sergeant who he called his secretary, who used to do all his paperwork for him. And they too were very aloof. They were out in the corner sort of thing all the time. Very rare that he joined with any of the other officers.
What was the name of the Israeli?
I can't remember, I'm afraid.
Did you like Wingate?
Oh, I liked him for what he did, yes. For the way he ran the operation. But I can't say that he was a type of general that... or brigadier, as he was at times, that I was able to work with on a personal basis.
What memories have you got of Sanford as a person?
Oh, he was a wonderful man. He actually lived in Ethiopia before the war started. He was farming out there. And then, of course, when the Italians went in 1935, he was outed and had to come back to Britain, and he brought the Emperor with him to Britain, and the Emperor stayed in Britain until this war. I liked Sanford extremely well. He was about 60 when we went in there, so he was getting on and carried a lot of fat weight with him about too. But nothing was too much for him. And he was a very, very brainy man, I would have thought. And, of course, he also knew the country and knew the Ethiopians, knew their mentality, which was takes some doing.
Did he have any faults?
Not that I know of, no. As far as I'm concerned, no.
What did he look like?
Charming man.
What was his actual appearance?
6 foot... big with it, bald head, jovial face. You'd put him as a farmer, a colonial farmer. That's what I would have thought he would have been.
What about Thesiger? What
Thesiger, Wilfred Thesiger, well, he's been a great explorer, and I think he's still going exploring through deserts, Sahara deserts, and he was in the paper the other day, as a matter of fact, an article and in Telegraph. Wonderful man. He was another man with a bag of nuts, and he could go off for five days a week or so with a bag of nuts and a water bottle, and off he'd go. He didn't worry about having fried eggs and bacon for breakfast or anything like that.
What did he look like?
Tall, gangling, tough as old boots, and could rough it with the next.
You didn't give a personal description of Wingate, what his appearance was.
Small, bearded, unshaven, long hair, very slight. And I honestly would have taken him more for a Jewish rabbi, looking at him in the distance.
When you say long hair,
the features.
How long?
Oh, very long. I mean, we had no razors, blades, soap or anything like that in those days. When we got to a river, we just stripped everything off and had a damn good wash and threw out the fleas and bugs and things like that. But he looked, though, he didn't worry much about washing or anything like that. His main object was the fighting and winning the battle.
I mean, was it shoulder length hair?
Oh, yes, quite shoulder length at times. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, the month that I was with him, I don't think he ever trimmed the beard or trimmed the hair. And I don't think there was a barber there in any case if he wanted one.
What colour hair did he have?
Dark brown.
Was he clean?
Well, none of us were clean, as I said, when we first went in there, we soon ran out of soap, as we did all food and etceteras. And the only time we had a wash is when we got to some water, i.e. a river or a pond, and then we stripped everything off, put all our clothes under the water to kill off the bugs and the beetles and the fleas and lice, and washed ourselves, and then we were clean again.
You had lice, did you?
Oh, gracious, yes. Couldn't be off it, because the Ethiopians are lousy people. And their houses, which are called tukuls, they are absolutely full of fleas and lice.